Hey, everybody. Welcome back to another edition of the Mundane Festival Podcast. I'm your host, Chris Lambert. Today is Sunday, November 11th, 2018. Remember, as always, you can subscribe to the show on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, and on Podbean, the host site. If you like the show, please rate and review it on Apple Podcasts and or Stitcher. Give it a five-star review. Let everyone know why you like it, because it will make me feel good about myself and most of the life decisions that I've made so far. You can email the show at mundanefestivalpod@gmail.com. Let me know what's on your mind. More importantly, what's on your heart? You can like the show on Facebook. You can follow it on Twitter at Mundane Festival. And you can follow me, your host, the guy talking to you right now on Twitter at Chris Lambert. This is episode 319. Super special return guest that you know and you love, comedian and podcaster, J.L. Covan from the Making Podcasts Great Again podcast. So I'm going to share that conversation with you in a bit. Right now, I'm going to talk to you. I am in beautiful Latham, New York, in the capital region of New York, like Latham, Albany, New York. I'm at a Residence Inn, and the power's out. The power is out, and I'm still doing this podcast because I care about you guys so much, and I don't know what's going to happen, and I'm working really hard. Yeah, so the power's out at this place, and they're trying to fix it. It'll soon be checkout time in a couple hours, but at least the internet's working, the Wi-Fi's working, and I'm powered up, bro. The only thing is my phone is kind of dying, and my phone is at like 28% right now. So I'm gonna get this pod to you eventually. I don't know when you'll get it, but you'll get it. It is pretty nice, despite the power being out. I gotta say, Residence Inn is pretty cool. Like, I'm in like a suite. It's almost like I'm in a condo, you know, like one of those, almost like a, I guess the closest thing it reminded me of was when I did a gig down in Myrtle Beach, South Carolina, and I stayed in condos. And that's what it looks. It's like they've got these buildings with little apartment style suites in it. And it's pretty neat. It's got the kitchen, a full size refrigerator and a freezer. They've got an oven. They've got a coffee maker, a TV. It's pretty dope. And they got a bathroom, obviously, and a bed. But like, the thing that I liked about Marriott is the fact that they have Netflix on the TV. They usually do, but this one doesn't. I have Netflix. You can watch it on my laptop, but it's pretty neat when you can log into your account and watch it on a TV, but this, they don't have it here, but I'm using my rewards points. So that's cool. I'm earning them. So I do like Marriott. So that's, if you're a traveler, if you travel and you got to book a hotel and you're not balling, I'm not balling, and it was pretty fucking affordable for a nice layout. I was up here. I did a one nighter at this place called the Arsenal City Tavern in Waterlivet, New York. It's outside of Troy. I just gave them shit about. I gave them shit, the audience shit about, like, how do you say this name and all this stuff, and had a good time. And then some people came there after. Actually, you know, this is supposed to be Western West Troy, New York, and you know, it's whatever. But I had a really good time. Shout out to Travis Steele for having me. Had like three or four comics. I did like 45 minutes. It was fun, man. I had a really good time. So it's always good to do the road and, you know, do it. In my old age, I always say this, I've said it hundreds of times, but there was no way that I was going to go home like doing a after doing a late night set like that, because it's 2 hours away. And in my old age, I don't like to drive that far at night. So this was a cool little landing spot. So I always loved the performing up here in the capital region. Yeah, so I had a good time. And this week was pretty chill. Nothing too crazy. I've been listening. I'll give you some. I'll talk about a little bit of music. I'll give you a movie review, and that's it. And I'll bring you to JL. So I went to the movies. I saw The Front Runner, and JL and I were supposed to do a big recap on The Front Runner because it was elections, midterms, and everything like that. And we just ended up talking about, you know, JL's long-winded and he talks a lot. So and he says a lot of smart shit. So it was basically, this is just a full-length episode. But I did see The Front Runner, and we talk about that in the episode. And then Thursday, I went to see The Girl in the Spider's Web, the girl with the dragon tattoo, the second American version. I don't know. I saw that and it was okay. It's not something that you would need to run out to the theater. If you saw this on cable or Netflix or Redbox, you'd be like, okay. Like, I like Claire Foy. Lakeith Stanfield's in it. He's got a cool little part. He comes in towards the end. The way he did his thing towards the end was pretty dope, but overall, it's just kind of, so it was decent. And then yesterday, I saw this movie called Wildlife, the Paul Dano movie, which I did like. I might do an indie movie corner. I might do like, the nerd in me held back from seeing it at the Jacob Burns Film Center, so I could go up here and see it at the Landmark Spectrum, which is an old theater that the Landmark franchise took over, I guess, recently. And they still keep it's an old school movie theater, but the picture quality is great, and it's a really nice theater. It's maintained really well, and it's not the stadium style seats, but the seats are comfortable, and you get a good picture on the movie screen and all that jazz. And they have fresh baked goods, which is really cool too. So I had a freshly baked, a homemade brownie with nuts. Pause. And so I don't do it. A homemade brownie with nuts and a water, and it was good. I enjoyed it. So those are the movies I saw. Music. I had on Tidal as I was getting ready for the show, and S.G. Lewis has a new album called Dark. S.G. Lewis is a musician from the UK, and he's had records with Dornick, who I really like. I told you about a couple years back. Dornick has been on a couple foreign exchange records. He's on Fonte's new album, No News Is Good News, album of the year, in my opinion. And a couple other really cool singers. So S.G. Lewis always seems to have his pulse on who these up-and-coming singers are, or just these really, really talented vocalists. So I found out about this woman. Now it's saying the page is unavailable due to internet connection. Did my internet die? Is my tweet deck still going? So it looks like, wait a minute. It looks like the internet might be dead. But anyway, just take my word for it. S.G. Lewis has like an EP called Dark. And they call it an album here, so it's like six songs, I think. And then where's this woman? I can get the name because on this page I can, because I clicked on this woman, and I found that I had already saved her. Aluna George, she's got an album out called Champagne Eyes, and she's a good singer. And then there's another, so I got to get into her, but she's on one of these S.G. Lewis records off of Dark. And then this dude named Bruno Major, who has the last who's singing on the last record of the song. He's got an album out called A Song for Every Moon. And it sounds dope. So his vocals sound dope. So I was vibing out to that. Was listening to the rapper Big Pooh album called RPM that I talked about last week. That's good. Daniel Caesar has a record out called Who Hurt You. That's just one single. So that's kind of what I've been listening to, like vibing out to. I told you, like, title is like Netflix for music. So I was vibing out to that. I think that's pretty much it. Hope everybody voted. Randolph Terrence and I did a midterm elections recap, and JL and I kind of got into it with his thoughts, like just not got into it, but I just had him talk about how he felt about it in the at the beginning of our conversation. And so it's over there on Patreon. If you love Randolph, like I know you guys do, go over there to the Patreon and sign up for that, because there's a lot of cool shit over there. It's not just movie reviews. It's other cool shit, too. And I'll try to give you at least two or three a month going forward. So I think that is it, you guys. So, like I said, JL and I, we were talking about catching up. I knew that he was into seeing The Front Runner, so I just hit him up, and I was like, "Well, you want to go see this? I'm going to be in the city. Do you want to check this out?" And he said, "Well, no, I got to go to a party, so I'm seeing it early." I was like, "Oh, let's just do a review on it," and he was like, "Cool." And then I saw one of his posts that's saying that he had issues with his back, and he was on opioids, and he was joking about that. And I said, "Well, hey, dude, let's just do a phoner and let's just shoot the shit and talk about this movie." And it basically became this episode, which was an hour and a half of us hanging out. So without further ado, let's get you to JL and yours truly talking about stuff. Yeah, okay. I saw the tweets about my Patreon midterm recap.
Yeah, just getting Chris Lambis flexing his Hollywood muscle and getting yeah. politically active.
Yeah, right. No, I
using that platform, that indie film and Netflix platform.
That's hilarious. No, I said it last week when the Selena Kopic episode. I said that I was a legislative intern in undergrad in high school. So this was under Paris Glendening, and I was a senator for Leo Green for like the whole term. That was like my senior year of college. It was cool. That's when I was interested in, like, I thought maybe I might get into journalism or be some type of talking head or just be involved in TV production and politics, but it just wasn't me. I just,
right.
And then, like, it's almost like when you try to get caught up into any type of show, it's like a comic book series or any type, one of these things that people are just balls to the wall invested in. And it's like, you try to keep up. I know some of the major players, and I know because of guys like you and Randolph and Rod, I listen to smart people. It's like, Eugene Levy said in Waiting for Guffman, where they asked him, he said, "Were you the class clown?" He said, "Nope, I wasn't the class clown, but I sat by him and I studied him." So that's kind of how I operate now. But I was
what a great line.
That's such a great, and I think he probably did that off the rip. I think that was probably improv, I'm assuming.
Right. Because that's the one I don't... Best in Show is the one I've seen by far the most of that of that troupe. But I only saw Guffman once.
A lot of,
that's a funny line.
A lot of people will say... And I'm not even a big movie quote guy, so that's a rough quote from it. That's like a rough interpretation. But that... I think that Guffman... A lot of people go with Spinal Tap as their number one. Selena and I were actually talking about this. People go with Spinal Tap as their number one. They'll go with Guffman, but I think for me it's Guffman 1, Best in Show 2. It might be Guffman and Guffman. It might be 1 and 1A really, but those are two of his best. Like Parker Posey is, you know,
and that's your acting. That's your acting sentimentality.
Yeah,
I think it was going because Best in Show also was the first one of those that I saw. So like it also might play a role in that. Having seen that one first, you kind of appreciate what they do the most from the one you saw first.
That's true. Yeah. A Mighty Wind, I know because of those two, I was super excited about A Mighty Wind when that came out. Like, I had the soundtrack and all that shit. but you, like, so what's your takeaway from this, the midterms?
To quote Greg Popovich, we live in a racist country. it's I'm still appalled that Donald Trump isn't like a fringe candidate. Mm-hmm. Like, I'm still not over the fact that he doesn't represent like a 5 to 8% of the country, but he represents 40% of the country.
Right.
Because like I said to people, and obviously I was a big Hillary Clinton fan.
Same.
I'm not one of those. I'm not like one of the begrudging, which I understand. I respect people who did not like her, but still just said, but I'm voting for her.
Yeah.
I don't appreciate the people who kind of didn't vote for her because they secretly assumed she would win, but they could still stay on their moral high horse.
Mm-hmm.
But I think I'm tired, you know, at some point, and I hope this is the turning point where people go, oh, it's not really her fault, because Obama in 08, awoke a lot of people. And let's just be fair. Not everybody who woke up to Obama was just some disenfranchised or cynical person. Some people were, you know, there were plenty of people who I'm sure were fairly ignorant of the political process and a mishmash of many different reasons why people didn't vote but came out to vote for Obama.
Right.
But to me, I go, but that represented a positive. Like, in other words, your reason for coming out to vote, let's say you are a 70-year-old black man in Alabama, and you go, I've never voted. They don't give a shit about me. I saw what they did to Dr. King, et cetera, et cetera.
Mm-hmm.
Like, if you just think you don't have a place in America, or you just go about your business and don't think voting matters, then you see a black man as the nominee, and you go, my God, I'm going to vote. I didn't think I'd see that.
Right.
You can say, because a lot of Trump people go, a lot of people voted for Obama just because he was black. Is that okay? And my thing is, kind of, because you have to look at it in context.
Right.
It's like, this is something so big in the context of this country's history that, like, you can say, yes, that person might not be the super informed voter, but they're also voting from a positive standpoint.
Right.
Whereas I think and Democrats just kind of made this big assumption, like, wow, look at what with the Obama coalition, the young, increased minority voting, like strong women voting. Well, then it's over for Republicans. And what Trump did is he bucked the Republicans had this idea that they were going to try and beat the Democrats at the demographics game. Like, well, we've got to chip away. We got to get more Latino voters. We've got to do better with women.
Mm-hmm.
Trump basically said, fuck that. There's a lot of angry, just like there might have been minorities and women and whoever who were energized by Obama for the first time. I'm telling you, there's angry internet incel white boys of all ages and all genders who are pissed off and feel like trans bathrooms and affirmative action and Obama's arrogance, in air quotes, bother them.
Right.
And I'm going to speak to them because we're going to get our 10 million voters who've never voted. We're going to get them to the polls. And that's what he did.
Yeah.
And I think people need to realize at this point that, like, I think, you know, a majority of this country is, you know, not racist and decent. Yeah. But I think there is a motivated 35 to 40% who require vigilance to be defeated. Like, you can't just kind of assume, well, a majority of the country is not racist. So what you need is a majority of the people voting, not a majority of the people breathing. Mm-hmm. And to me, it's like, this election was so close. I look at Florida and I'm like, you have a scumbag, like, bigot jerk who's able to, like, be neck and neck, if not beat Andrew Gillum. Stacey Abrams, they could paint, you know, the voter suppression in Georgia. You could paint her. What's so funny about her is she's a Yale law graduate. Now, that usually would give Trump a boner if she was a white guy.
Right.
But she's a Yale law graduate, number one law school in the country. She's the House minority leader in Georgia. Like, she's basically Nancy Pelosi in Georgia with a law degree from Yale. Mm-hmm. And he's going, she's not qualified, because his instinct is like, yeah, my people and me, I think he believes this himself, is to say, well, a black woman, like, come on. Like, in other words, he doesn't have to say anything further to his people. It's like, you know the deal. She's a black woman. I mean, Yale, sure, but she probably got in there some other way. And like, you know, it's, come on. She's like a chubby, like, kind of like happy black woman. Like, she's not serious. Like, this isn't serious politics. Mm-hmm. Now, Brian Kemp, the attorney general, is a, you know, a serious looking white man. That's a governor. And I'm oversimplifying it, but I really think that's psychological process that a lot of these people go through.
Oh, I don't think you're simplifying. I think you're hitting the nail on the head.
It's what I've said, and I've said this before, and this is, I don't mean to pretend like my experience, this is all innate to me. I've read a lot as well, but where you realize, to a lot of people, the default America is, they like to say it's the ideals, the principles, the values, but it's white. To a lot of people, those things are secondary, because when they are, in the person of Barack Obama as the best example, when you are presented with the embodiment of all of America's ideals and principles and values, half immigrant, half Kansas, half black, half white, rags to riches, World War II grandfather, raises up through education and opportunity, becomes a successful, wealthy person. That is a professor, a president, an author. That should be like, oh my God, doesn't matter what race, what color, what anything, that is the embodiment of the American dream and the thing we pride ourselves on. But his name's Barack and he's black. So to a lot of people, it's like, he's not one of us. He's Muslim. He's this. He's not any Christian I've ever heard of. Mm-hmm. And it's because to a lot of America, I'm not even saying a majority, but to a lot. And sometimes people can be guilty of this who are black, who are, when you say hardworking American, I guarantee you the image that popped into my head, the initial image, I bet if they did psychological studies, you just think, it's been hammered into your head, you think like white guy with a mustache and a flannel shirt going into a steel factory with a lunch pail. Mm-hmm. That's just kind of like what's put, like, and then obviously if you take a second to think, some people will just keep thinking that, and other people go, oh no, well, it could be a black guy going to a doctor's office. It could be a Mexican guy working in a grocery store. It could be a woman doing, they're all American. They all are hardworking, middle-class Americans.
Right. But it's like my mom and my dad were. That's what they are.
But I think, and like I said, I think if we're all, and I'm not saying everybody, if I'm honest with myself, that split second when somebody says hardworking American, if you just probably measured my brain activity, if this were possible, the first image would probably be white factory guy.
I could see that.
Not even because I believe that is the American. It's just like that's what the culture, the white for so many things has been the default.
Right.
Like the default. So anything else is special rights or different or others. Whereas it's like, no, technically, America, the greatness of America, if you really believe it and know it, is supposed to be the structure, the values, the opportunity, that whatever you look like, whoever you are, you can fit into those if you, as Bill Clinton would say, work hard and play by the rules.
Right.
But for a lot of people, Trump included, I think this is also the problem, is that Trump embodies his supporters. His thing is like, his ranking is white men, I think celebrities of any kind that support him, because he does value fame a lot and attention.
Right.
Then it goes like white women who support him. And then from there on out, it goes like Latin people that support him. And then you get to the rankings of people who don't support him, ending with, it seems pretty apparent, black women. Like, lowest on his list is black women who don't support him.
Yeah.
They rank even on the lowest of his opponents. So that's very long. I mean, that's a little long, but I think what these elections showed me is that still, no matter whether it's a progressive agenda, I think the Democrats had a very good night. I think there's been a lot of gerrymandering in the House. That was a very decisive win in the House, considering how things have been set up. They won a lot of governorships, which will help with the gerrymandering issue come 2020. Mm-hmm. And I think, but Georgia and Florida, you know, Texas, I think, you know, Beto is still a superstar, and he came relatively close, and he also helped many House candidates in Texas win because he increased turnout so much. But the ones that really disappointed, Texas didn't disappoint me as much because I think there were still benefits and he still has a bright future. But Georgia governor and Florida governor were really disappointing because yeah. I think, and this was a long-winded way, I think I started almost approaching this, but yeah, when I talked about Stacey Abrams, it's like easy to label her some like either unqualified because you're sort of a racist who doesn't see a black woman as capable or as equally capable. But it's also easy to label someone like that a radical or a super left, even though she has a reputation for being a political moderate and somebody who does work with the other side to accomplish things, especially because she's not in the majority in the Georgia House. That tells me something else about people. They're so easily manipulated because they go, yeah, well, that makes sense that a black woman, which is already seeing a black woman in power, is so unique to me that it's very easy to paint her with a radical or extreme label because her very existence and position seem radical to me. So I think that's what happened with Obama. He governed like a centrist and was a very measured, thoughtful man. But his name and skin tone being so radical and different for the position he was in triggered, I think, a lot of Americans into going, well, I can easily believe he's a radical or he's this or that, because just looking at him is radical. And it is, but I don't mean that in a negative way.
Yeah.
But I think it was easily manipulated into a radical concept, and you could ascribe to him any kind of negative you wanted because people are like, yeah, well, Barack and a black man, I mean, it makes, yeah, he wants to white, you know, and then you get the real idiots who will be like, yes, white genocide. And he hates, I mean, I was personally offended when Glenn Beck was saying, you know, back in 2010, I think Barack Obama hates white people. And I'm going, like, how do you get away with saying that? How do you believe that? And how do you get away with saying it? It's like the man was raised by a white mom and white grandparents who served, you know, his grandfather was in World War II. You know, we respect our veterans, but I guess not their half black grandkids. But right. The idea that you could honestly think he hates white people, and then for enough people, like, in other words, if you said that about me, if I were running for president, I think more people would find that to be weird because they'd be like, look at him. He looks Italian. Why would he hate white people? But with Obama, it was like, yeah, well, you know, he seems pretty out there. So very long. I was just very disappointed. I think it's good news in general, but I think the fact that the Trump movement has so much strength and passion behind it, is the right thing in terms of democracy, but is really bad for this country. Like, but you can't help it. I mean, you have to swarm them. You have to just get more people out voting. Like, my best friend just changed his I always used him as my example on my podcast. He's been a registered Republican since he was 18. He changed to unaffiliated because he just, to him, it's no longer, well, I'm a non-Trump Republican. The Republican Party is Trump.
Right.
At some point when it's like, and I know I defend the Catholic Church all the time, not abuse, but I always am asked to sort of, how can you still be a part of the church? And admittedly, pedophile is horrible, but I can tell you if, and I know it's not the same thing as political affiliation, you know, one pedophile is worse than a million bad political ideas.
Hmm.
But if it were 90% of priests were pro-child abuse, well, then obviously I'd be like, well, it doesn't matter if I'm in the 10%. It's a toxic and many people feel it's toxic already, but it's, you know, my friend, I think, just was like, well, I can't keep defending the, well, I'm not one of the Trump Republicans, because you know what? Once you reach a critical mass of 90% supporting him, that is the party.
Yeah, well, the GOP allowed it to happen. They allowed him to.
Oh, they
beat all.
They set the conditions. They you know, nurtured the soil so that it could grow a giant piece of orange shit.
Yeah. Well, what do you think about Matt Whitaker?
Yeah, it's a joke. Mm-hmm. I read my law professor from Georgetown wrote an op-ed in the Times. Neil Katyal, about how it's basically unconstitutional that he appoints somebody who should have Senate approval. Somebody with that, like in that position, should have Senate approval. Mm-hmm. It's a setup. It's such a transparent setup that he's sending this guy in, if not to end the investigation, to basically spy on the investigation.
Yeah.
It's so brazen and transparent and absurd. And it's sad. Like this guy, I mean, it's a joke, except it's not.
Right. Right. Cause he was on CNN maybe a month or so ago talking about what he would do if he was trying to get rid of the investigation.
Oh, sure.
Yeah, like whittling it down until you could...
Right, or starve them of funding or whatever. But it's, you know, I really hope to see video of Donald Trump Jr. doing CrossFit in prison one day. I think that would be awesome. But the thing is, I remember I was talking to my buddy, and we were talking about if any of the Trumps go to jail, and he said he only thinks that Trump would care if Ivanka went to jail. And my thinking is I think he's such a terrible person, and so devoid of like true parental instincts, like that most animals in the animal kingdom have.
Yeah.
But I feel like as long as he wasn't in jail, he would sleep okay. Like in other words, if I was accused of a crime and my mom could take my place in prison,
she would.
Now I'm not saying every parent has to do that, but I feel like that is an instinct in a lot of parents. Like protecting my offspring is like paramount in my parental instincts.
Yeah.
I really think Trump, if all his kids went to jail on fraud, like conspiracy, I mean all of them except Barron, like if Ivanka, Donald Jr. and Eric went to jail but Trump was not in jail, he'd be like, see, I told you, they couldn't catch me. And that would be it. Like he'd be kind of like, I think it's mean what you're doing to my kids, but you can't touch me.
Yeah.
I won't go as far as say as he would flip on one of his kids, but it wouldn't shock me if he just like agreed to testify against Don Jr.
Yeah. He
did
would.
It. Right. He did it. He's I didn't know he was such a liar, but you know, you can't win them all. I still have some good kids.
Can we talk a little bit about, I don't know that you're getting enough credit for making podcasts great again. I mean, I'm not just born.
Oh, I'm not, but thank you. But that's par for the course. That's,
but before
I'm
we,
about
before
that
we get into that,
life.
I know, but like, that's really fucking incredible work, because it's not only like, yeah, you sound like the guy, but it's so good that there's empathy for that Trump in a way where it's like, because I was listening to, I listened to a backlog of them like in a chunk while I was doing laundry like last week. And it was just like, God, you know, even when he goes off the record, it's like, he's an idiot. What's cause this guy, you know what I mean? Like he doesn't know. And it's, there's something, there's just a tinge of that's a fully formed character. It's not just
right.
It's not just like propped
up.
Yeah,
I tried to go the Colbert, you know, the Colbert Report version of Trump.
Yeah.
It's like the whole, you're in the character. Yeah, thank you.
It's really good, cuz especially when you and then the work your Kavanaugh was, there was, you know, those characters, I think it's more, I like the Kavanaugh too, even though it was, you could almost say that it was like the beer, I like beer, my kids, I coach the basketball. there's something there where you can have there's empathy towards these relatively despicable people,
right?
And a lot of times you don't get that. You get stuff that's either wooden or maybe it's made to look like the guy or whoever's in person. It's just a fully formed character. And then when you and Jordan get together, Jesus Christ, man! did you guys do your serious show together with him?
Yeah, and they won't let us. They won't let us put the episode out. Like, we have it for demo purposes to like shop around to see if anybody wants to give us a weekly show.
Yeah,
but it's it was. For anybody, and you know, I guess whoever's listening, if you're not listening to Making Podcasts Great Again, it's a quickie. It's like a 40 minutes a week, very funny, kind of a very accurate but humorous political break.
Mm-hmm.
But that hour we did on Sirius was obviously, I think, the episode where I did Kavanaugh jumping back and forth with mm-hmm. the voices was pretty was good in terms of a skill showcase, but.
Yeah.
This show we did on Sirius was off the charts. Like I was so happy. Not thoughts and prayers, you know, Captain Phillips crying happy, but I was very, very satisfied with how it went. Like in terms of, I've been doing this for so long and so frequently now that I really think I can just turn it on and just operate the way I think he would operate.
Yeah.
That show was, it was awesome. And I keep thinking, I wish I could write a script for this. I kind of did in one of my sketches about like a homeless guy who sounds like Trump who then debates Hillary Clinton. I really think if whoever gets the presidential nomination, I'm going to write them a letter and say, this may sound crazy, but I genuinely believe I'm a law graduate from Georgetown. I'm a politics junkie and I have the best Trump impression around. Here's a sample. I think I could debate prep your candidate better than anybody out there for Trump.
Now, can you speak to, I agree with you that it's the best Trump, but can you speak to why it is? I mean, I said what I thought that makes it, but what I thought that makes it the best, not just because
I think, but
can you speak sure. to that a little bit?
Well, I think the first thing is I was working on The Voice before other people were, because when I was doing appearances on the Carolla show, he would bring up Trump once in a while. And before Trump announced his candidacy, or right around when he announced his candidacy, I had just made a video for Carolla's show
mm-hmm.
where I was Obama, Bernie Sanders, and
right.
Trump.
Right.
And I'm sorry. I was Carolla, Obama, and Trump. I believe that was the three that I did in one video. And the impression has gotten much better, but I think it began with not focusing on the lips or the eyes, which a lot of people do, like Baldwin. Mm-hmm. It was just the voice. To me, the voice is always the most important thing. And I think my voice, it's not so far away from Trump, my normal voice. Obviously, it's a little bit, but I just kind of have to put like a, almost like I'm having trouble breathing and have a little bit of a sore throat.
Mm-hmm.
But then for what it's not worth much, obviously, but for what it's worth,
no, but however it's more than the voice though. That's what I'm saying.
That's what I was going to get to next.
Yeah.
For whatever it's worth, my brain, which used to be good at a lot of things and now seems to only be good at, writing jokes. I'm very like, I've always been very good at picking up on tics, on habits, mm-hmm. on different things people do. And with Trump, there's not a wealth of them, but it's basically, I don't want to sound, no offense to a real thespian, but I sort of adopt that. I don't know if it's an acting thing where I don't want to say because it sounds pretentious to be like, I become him, but it's like, I let go. Like, in other words, I let go of, decency.
Yeah.
I let go of my focus. I'm usually a fairly focused person. So I just kind of go like I'm standing in my kitchen and I'm looking at a glass and there's, why did my girlfriend leave her earrings on the table. I don't know why there's earrings. There's earrings right there, but they look like good earrings. But we've got the MCT oil. They say that's good for you, good for the brain. But it's cloudy outside, by the way. Have you noticed this? A lot of clouds.
Yeah.
We're not doing too well in the weather department. It's just like you, it's...
The filters are unfiltered.
It's just kind of like I take away the filter. And I am obsessed with the only things that drive me. It's very animalistic almost in terms of I am focused on, like I joke with my girlfriend about Cookie, where she can be distracted very easily. So he's very easily distractible, but the only guiding principle is like self-gratification or self-aggrandizement. So that's the North Star, if you will. Like everything can be spoken about as long as we get back to the focus, which is I'm the best and facts can't penetrate that. So I might be talking about, we got CNN on, they're very bad news, very fake news. We're looking at the dog sitting on the couch. But let me tell you something, I've trained this dog unbelievably well. A lot of people say, maybe the best trainer, maybe the best.
Mm-hmm.
And that's it. Like, that's, you don't have to hear, you have to just stay, I think, really committed to those things. Lack of focus and self-aggrandizement.
Yeah, because it's really like, because when you see other people, you see other people, it's just like, yeah. Yeah, man, I think more people should be listening to that pod, man.
No, we're trying. I think it's, as Mason said, as much as I think of my comedy skills in general, my stand-up skills, when it comes to the Trump, you know, it's the LeBron of the Trump impressions, but it's playing in the D-League.
Well, it would be just like say, when something pops, they'll say, oh, the guy does that Trump impression. That's the guy that's on the radio, we'll go see him at the club. Oh, he's a great comic.
Right.
It's just one of those things where some people you might see on a TV show or something, and then you see them playing in your town, and you go see him, you're like, fuck, that guy, he's not the goofy guy on that TV show.
Yeah, so. Well, that's what I was hoping with a lot of the different things I've done, but, you know, from my conscience got me to not go back on the Carolla show, even though I keep saying I have nothing personal against the guy, but the brand of the show became much closer to like Compound Media than I was comfortable with.
Yeah, dude, that's kind of been the hot topic on the last, not the hot topic, but it's come up in the last three or four episodes of this show where it's become a thing where it's like, what's going on up there in New York with that stuff? And it's
it was one of those with Carolla, it was just, it went from like 10% alt-right to like, it felt like 50%,
mm-hmm.
To which I'm just like, nothing personal, keep doing a show. I do think you're funny, but it's like, I'm not trying to attract your fan base anymore. Like, I don't really need a lot of the people that gravitate there as my fans. And obviously I think Kumia is a piece of shit. That I don't ever need to be affiliated with. That's to do with Compound Media. But, no, I think the problem is, even more so than politics, I think with comedy, there has been a justifiable backlash in terms of people saying what's funny and who can say this and how you discriminate and what you, like,
mm-hmm.
But that's given sort of a, you know, I think Trump is ridiculous and there's no excuse for him, but I can understand why a comedy fan or a comedian might be more inclined, even if I'm not, be more inclined to go to kind of the free speech conservative warrior type comics. Because unlike common decency in society, I do think comedy needs to be freer than, you know, school teachers and politicians.
Yeah.
Well, I think comedy should be dirtier and freer. So, like, I'm more inclined to at least understand why people would want to go to Carolla or even worse, to Kumia. But
mm-hmm.
at the end of the day, I still don't, like, particularly like the direction that some of those things have gone in. But it's also different. It's not politics. Politics should be held to a higher standard. But, you know, that's just my opinion, I guess.
No, I agree. I think they should. And, you know, it's always easy to say, they're trying to come at comedians. We're supposed to be the fun. I get it, but it's at the same time, you have to have some type of of base, you're a human being, you know, so you want to have some kind, like, if you're going to tell these jokes, but people come to the comedy club to see us take those risks and to, like, to do, you know, to do those things, like what Pete Davidson's joke that he told on the Weekend Update. People were trying to come at him like he was a senator.
That was dumb. And I thought the thing with Pete Davidson, in addition, I get it. People were going to get upset about him making the joke about the eye, but a lot of people got upset with the, I mean, so, okay. So he's like, he did it. It happened in a war, big deal. He's clearly being like a doofus character when he says that. I'm sure off camera, he's not going to like, he's not going to go, oh, big deal. He lost his eye fighting for the country. I don't care.
Right.
He was saying that because he's like a slacker doofus on that show.
Right.
So, like, you know what I mean? So for somebody to get mad at that, it's like, come on. He's clearly, they're laughing because he's, it's so ridiculous that he's dismissing it. They're not laughing because they think it's funny that the guy was, you know, lost his eye in battle.
Yeah.
They're laughing because this guy's being an idiot about it.
Right.
But I think the biggest thing I have, and maybe why it's good that my comedy career is effectively over, is the,
you just,
I have
did
noticed,
a show last week.
Well, I can't help it if somebody wants to hand me money and I only have to take the bus three stops.
I'm just giving you shit. I'm just trying to, I'm just keeping you.
And I had a phenomenal set. I hadn't been on stage in like a month and I crushed.
I'm sure you did.
But the, but I have noticed that I think people, whether it's because people are consuming their comedy different ways or smarter people think of themselves as funny and don't want to go to shows, or people aren't as into live entertainment that they can't be a part of. I have noticed over the last like 2 years, so I'm not trying to make it too narrow a gap, but I've noticed I've performed for dumber and dumber audiences.
You've mentioned that before. It does... It,
because I'm not up there. I'm a smart guy and I'm a real good comic, but I am not Dennis Miller up there.
No, you're not.
I try to be the thing I would say, and I have their obituaries still hanging on my bulletin board in my apartment. The two guys, in addition to Gary Gulman, who's like my one inspiration, who's still alive.
Yeah,
comedy to me, if you were to draw sort of a line of brains and content and style, I feel like it's somewhere between Greg Giraldo and Patrice O'Neill. Those are two of the guys that I think I pick from. I'm obviously not stylistically like Patrice O'Neill, but I've had bits where I've written and gone, that feels like maybe a little bit, like 5% of that inspiration came from his wing of the comedy world.
Sure.
And those are the three guys that I think, I like to think of myself as my own unique self, but I do see sort of inspiration from those three, maybe a little bit of Burr as well. But, I try to be more of a Giraldo thinking comic, which is like, you had to be smart to come up with that joke, but you don't have to be a genius to get it.
Yeah.
Whereas Dennis Miller is like, unless you're bringing like a master's in philosophy, and a degree in political science, you might not follow all that he's saying.
Mm-hmm.
I still notice that I feel like I kind of peaked around maybe 2014 in terms of best crowd reactions and feeling like everything was clicking. And the last 2 years, as I've continued to write material that I think is good and in keeping, and even doing older jokes, like when on the road, if I'm middling, which is almost all I do, you do your 15 minutes that you've been working on for the last year in case you have any fans come back. And then you got your 10 to 12 just standard, you don't know me, here's 10 to 12 minutes of greatest hits up top to get you going. And even those jokes I sometimes see start to fail a little bit more, and I'm like, they're not stale, they're like evergreen sort of greatest hits. And I've just started to feel like whether it's we as a people are getting dumber, or if the people coming out to comedy shows around the country are getting a little slower, I'm not sure, but I think I don't know. I don't think it's as much as people feel like it's a boom for comedy, and I don't need to get into all the things I've written in terms of why I think it's a bubble waiting to burst. I don't know. I don't think it's the greatest climate for artistic development in comedy. I think it's great if you're already a headliner. I think there's 20 different ways for you to make a lot of money. But as far as just the quality and the value of stand-up comedy, I think is plummeting.
Yeah, I still don't think it's respected enough as it should be.
Oh, and it's going to get less respected, I think, not more.
Right. And you look at the New York, we're recording this during the New York Comedy Festival, mm-hmm. and it just looks like the shows that they put on, it's like, what? I don't know, but and it's not even because I'm not booked on it. I could give it, you know, it's like you see the, maybe, you know, Burr was at MSG, that's awesome, but, you know, I don't know. Maybe I'm an asshole, but yeah, I look at some of the people that are getting these shows, and you're just like, oh, this person probably has a good manager and a good agent.
Yeah, that's why, you know, making podcasts great again. As much as I want to quit, that's keeping my. I'm acknowledging that I'm keeping my foot in there because, you know, I'm hoping that you know, for the 10th time, that something I have that's good will maybe elevate and get me. Some opportunities, but I just laugh with the fact that, you know, Israeli Tortoise, my album in 2016, hit number one and sold like over double the number of copies that Thoughts and Prayers has sold.
Do you think that is?
Well, part of it is I did not want to make the album $19.99. I submitted a price of $12.99 because I thought, well, it's a double album. I would like to get more mm-hmm. than $9.99, but I submitted $12.99 thinking that was very reasonable. Of course, iTunes just said $19.99. I'm like, it would have been cheaper to sell them as two different albums because $9.99 and $9.99 is $19.98. Yeah. So by selling them as a double album, you actually are charging $19.99, which is a cent more than if I had broken them up into two totally different albums.
One being Thoughts and one being Prayers, like
exactly.
Sweatsuit, like Nelly.
Exactly. But I think people don't care anymore. I think part of the reason is I am not a star. I think there is a value now placed on, and I'm not talking about famous people who do comedy. I'm talking about if you're a comedian, being famous or being super successful is people, even fans of mine who became followers or purchasers of other albums.
Yeah.
I'm not famous. Like, I haven't made it. And I think that kind of, for unless you're a super fan, like our boy Keith Blair.
Yeah, shout out to
that, Keith. That can, like, make people kind of go, oh, he's still doing it, huh? It's like, but if you thought my last album was flame emojis, then that's all you should have to... That's all you should have to need to keep supporting me.
And that's
but
how,
I think, and I,
yeah, that's, yeah. It's weird because, like, I'm a consumer too. Like, I tell jokes and I do stuff, but I consume, especially when it comes to music. If I know right. a person's good, like right now I got Saint Vincent on mute, like one of her, like she's doing like an ACL Austin City Limits festival, and I just have her on mute playing. She's so
uh-huh. hard.
But anyway. I liked her in 2007. So right. when it comes time for her to put a project out, I'm going to buy it. You know what
right.
I mean? And some album like this last one, I don't like it as much as I liked her other shit, but it's still very good.
Right.
And I went to go see her in concert. So it's like a thing you have you're supposed to be building these relationships, but I guess because you don't have that capital of the Instagram likes and all this other shit that.
But what I don't, my issue with this album, which I expected to be my best seller. Now I wasn't like, I'm gonna sell 10,000 copies. No, I was hoping to sell a couple hundred because obviously I'll make good money on royalties for the next couple of years from like satellite radio and streaming and stuff. But what I was hoping was, okay, Making Podcasts Great Again is now clicking in at like, we've had like back to back weeks of 1,000 downloads.
Mm-hmm.
That's good because we're 6 months in and we've already hit. This week is a big test, but we're hoping that after the serious show, we maybe get that up even a little bit more. But after 6 months, we'll be at a regular audience that is basically where Righteous Prick was at its peak. Mm-hmm. So that's good. That's a good sign. But when I say to the Righteous Prick listeners or downloaders, who knows how many of do which, and to the Making Podcast Great Again listeners, I'm like, hey, you're listening to this, so I assume you like me or you like my comedy, like my what I do. So I'm asking for you, since these podcasts are free, since the videos, which cost me hundreds of dollars to make each time I put out a sketch video, since you like those, since maybe you read my website, maybe you've seen me perform live, just go buy the album. It's $20, but it's $20 and then it's yours. And there won't be another album, or if there, God forbid, is another album, it won't be till like 2022. So for $20, consider this like a 3 to 10 year subscription to all the shit I put out. But also, I'm assuming you like my comedy. I'm not just asking you to like Venmo me $20 just for being nice.
Right. There's a
product.
It's a high quality product.
I sometimes wonder if I should have just made the album sale like a GoFundMe, because people seem to be triggered by that to go, oh, I'll support. And it's like, no, but I'm just saying, now we cut out the GoFundMe, just buy the album, you get the album, and I get the money. And the sales are terrible, and I have more friends, more followers, more outlets. Like, I had the Levitard thing, which gained me some real fans on the internet. And you kind of go, I have more fans, more followers, podcasts that has increased my reach to people who actually like listen to my content. And then I go, and yet the album sale is less than 50% what Israeli Tortoise was. And I think it's a much better album than Israeli Tortoise, and even better than the album I always said was my best, which was Keep My Enemies Closer. I think it's not only is it better, it's a lot better, and I think it's my best. And yet I couldn't sell. And I'm talking about just to my people. I'm not talking about, oh, maybe this will get picked up and go platinum. No, I'm thinking just, why didn't I sell the most of this album? And I think the answer is people either, you know, they like your statuses on Facebook, or they don't value comedy enough to purchase it, or something, or you're not famous. So they don't, it's not as, no matter what I do, if I'm not doing 10 Conan spots and 3 Jimmy Fallon spots and appearing in a movie, I think people maybe just look at it as like some indie hobby that like I'm good at, but it's not worth their time. So,
yeah.
Whereas if I was famous and it was my first album and it sucked, like it was like some Jay Farrow or Nick Cannon product, it would sell, you know, 10,000 copies. Even if it was like not good.
Oh, shots fired.
You know what I mean? And I say not with love to Nick Cannon, because his special did bring me joy, but not in a good way. But Jay Farrow, I say that out of respect for somebody who thinks he is a supremely gifted impersonator. I didn't even understand why he did a stand-up special, considering that, you know, his money seemed like it was probably pretty good and he could headline clubs and do movies and TV shows. I didn't know. That was the comic in me saying, if you don't have a good album or a good special in you, wait. Especially when you're not money. When you're not starving. But I'm saying, if you're not starving, why put out a bad product?
You and I know
would
that.
Would be my question.
But then we've never been offered that, the bag like that, as most as the young folks.
I know, but I'm telling you, I doubt he got a ton of money for his showtimes. That like, I don't think he, that it's definitely not a, I'd be shocked if that was a 7-figure deal. And then he got a show with Showtime, like, what is it called? White Famous?
Yeah.
I'm just saying he did get an actual TV show, which probably paid more than the stand-up special.
Probably.
So that's my whole thing is just like when Dane Cook did a bunch of bad movies, except for My Best Friend's Girl, which was like his last movie.
With Jason
which is
Biggs,
really good.
Right?
Yeah.
That was good.
That was good, and I felt like, see, if he had had better management, I think they would have said, or less greedy management, I think they would have said, this is the right one for you to do. Instead, he did like 5 in a row that none of them were hits, and none of them were reviewed well. My Best Friend's Girl was actually good, but by then, people were like, Dane Cook movies suck.
Yeah, they were over it.
But I think like when he did those movies, I was just like, dude, you're making 7 figures a year doing stand up. You don't have to do 5 movies.
Well, like, that,
Yeah. You can pick and choose and be smart because you have a big house. You are rich. Do you see what I mean? Like, yeah, if somebody offered me a terrible movie right now for like $100,000 or $500,000, I'd be like, absolutely.
You're taking it.
Like, I need that money. That my priority is money. But when your priority should be expanding your career, when money isn't the necessity, then start smart decisions. You know, that's my advice. So I don't begrudge anybody who needs the money prioritizing money. But when you're a millionaire and you're still prioritizing money over quality, mm-hmm. that to me seems foolish.
That was like 3 years ago before Burr started doing arenas. I went to see him do his Wilbur Week. I went to
in Boston. Yeah,
in Boston, and he was saying to me after the show, I was talking to him, and he was saying, "Yeah, you know, I could have played the Garden for one night, but I wanted to work on my act, or I could have just like did the Garden, and then like wait around all day to say two lines in a movie all summer. I could have did that, but I wanted to work on my act, you know? And that's like that's." What you think about? Because yeah, he doesn't need to do 15 shows in 2 weeks, but that's what he wants to do, and he doesn't have to.
Right, but at the same time, he's prioritizing. You know, not to sound again like an actor, but he's prioritizing the work, right. so to speak. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, he also is not like I'm a feature act making $600 a week, and the Garden just offered me. $800,000
Right.
He's like, well, I can make, you know, $100,000 from the Wilbur this week, or $250,000 from the Garden, but it's a one-time thing, and that's a big stage that I want to make sure I get right.
Right.
Exactly. I'll take the $100,000, still be living large, and know that I'm advancing. You know, and then you look where he is,
yeah.
bigger than ever.
Yeah.
Second time at the Garden. Mm-hmm. You know, doing TV shows, doing movies, like, oh, and what, oh, was that, wait a second.
What?
Did you bring up Burr as a way to segue into the movie?
Partly, but I was thinking, we've talked for so long, I was thinking maybe we could just, I wanted maybe this, the whole thing to be Patreon, but I don't know. I might split it up.
I think an important message about listening to Making Podcasts Great Again maybe deserves a broader audience.
Yeah, than the five people on my Patreon page. But yeah, no, I did say that, but when we will get to that, but it is definitely you want to have because you want if you get on a TV show and people go see it and they say, oh, I like this guy from that TV show. He does stand up. Let's see him. You better fucking have something for them.
Yes.
Because they're not coming back.
Right.
Like, I've worked with some of these people. Like, if you don't have, like, if you, there's no second or third time. Well, some people get the second and third time around.
Hey, lambs.
Oh, boy. But I'm not even like talking about that. I'm talking about like mega fame people that are still like trying to hold on to fame that they don't have anymore. Like they're still trying to, you know, be out there in the public and they don't have a fucking act.
Right. That reminds me, my favorite example of that is Angie Salazar, who like as late as like 4 or 5 years ago was still headlining clubs. He's
Angel a little Salazar?
Latin comic, yeah, who played one of Tony Montana's friends in Scarface in 83.
I opened for him earlier this year. I opened for him in Perth Amboy for like...
check it out? Is that his catchphrase?
Yeah, I opened for him twice. Like once, I think once I emceed for him at Bananas and then... I opened for him in Perth Amboy like spring of this year and they fucking loved him.
Right. That's when I say, you know what? Sometimes the blame belongs with stupid people.
hey man, I you know if people are paying for it, you know
I know.
But it's like,
but sometimes, see, but that's when people go, why is the news covering, and I know stand-up comedy is not the news, but when people go, why is the news covering Lindsay Lohan, you know, mm-hmm. blowing a guy in a parking lot, people are like, because it's getting thousands or millions of clicks.
Did she
that's
really
why.
That?
No.
Okay,
no.
I was about to look for the video.
No, but I'm saying that, in other words, people love to point the finger at, like, the source going, why, if you'd cover something better, you're degrading our culture. It's like, well, it goes hand in hand. Our right. culture is also degrading itself. So
yeah.
if a club wants to nurture talent and develop talent, which none of them really do,
mm-hmm.
then they might not book that guy. But if the audience is not willing to give newer comics or to trust newer comics or to embrace comedy.
Yeah.
They're there for celebrity telling jokes versus I'm here for comedy and hope to discover some comedians. That's the trade-off. And I think almost everybody in this business at this point is much more in favor of fill the seats. I don't care if you're a WWF wrestler, a podcaster talking about the Real Housewives or anything, as long as you fill seats. Our comedy clubs are going to quickly become more like event spaces than stand-up comedy clubs.
Well, I think it's already headed towards that, and that's a actual great way to describe it, because, man, like, you go to these places, because, Levity Live is basically my home club, because that's
sure.
the only club that I'm past at, and it's like auditing a class when you go, you see these performers come in. For the past 5 years that I've been working with that club, and you get to see the people that are really working on their act, or people that are coasting through it, or it's a different thing. And it's like, you know, I think as a comic, like from where I'm at my level, almost 10 years in, it's good to be around as much as possible. But it's like, I took something to heart, what you said about doing the road. It's almost like, is that like, you said something like it's kind of like it's fruitless, or it's kind of like an ego thing.
Yeah, that's right. I've said a lot of the things I've done in my career, whether it's traveling, you know, doing Corolla or this, once or twice is good for either the experience or the
yeah.
exposure. But after a while, it becomes an ego thing of saying, well, look, I'm working, but then, and it's valuable stage time, but at the same time, you're going, but I'm, at some point, me being 15 years in, I'm like, I'm losing money. Like, even if I'm making money on the road, there's more money to be made if I just sit in an office during the day. And mm-hmm. once I lose hope that I'm going to break through, now all I'm doing is performing so I can tell people I'm still performing and that, like, I'm at this club or that club. But for my life, what's better, to make $1,100 in a week and not travel, or to net $420 in a week traveling, telling people I'm a comedian, even though it's not advancing my career. And, all I'm doing is costing myself money to make myself. And I'm not saying this is the way it should be for all comics. I'm saying at this point in my career,
sure,
where I'm like, I don't really understand why something I've done hasn't broken through beyond, you know, mild praise. But you have to face it, you know, look at it realistically at this point and just say, yeah, it's probably not going to happen. So what's better for my life? Not for my ego, or not for my sense of, like, I'm still a comic out there doing it. But what's better, you know, what's better for my overall, you know,
for your overall sanity and your
well-being.
You got
yeah.
examples of some of your friends that are doing fine that are, I just feel like, I was talking to another comic Saturday night after doing Alex Barnett and Dan Enfield's show at Gotham, that late show. And she was telling me, she's like, this can't be it. Like, I can't, like, this is just like, you can't, like, just keep going doing these shows, like, and busting your ass and doing all these shows. Like, I love doing, like, I'm going to Albany tomorrow, where I'm doing a bar show, and I got to get a hotel. They're not giving me the hotel, but I got to book the room so I don't, like, drive off the road coming back, because I'm tired, you know?
But what I've said, and here's my, you know, bi-monthly pep talk or encouragement, you should be working the parallel tracks.
Yeah.
Because I think not only are you keeping your comedy skills honed, though I'm very disappointed that there's still no word of a Lambert album in production.
It's in the, that's what I'm working towards. Like, I was just telling, okay. I was telling Randolph.
Well, I'm going to tell you, I said this last week. No, you're there. You just have to set the date and then narrow it down and focus. You've worked towards a first album. Like, the work has been done.
But do you know, let me stop you there. Do you know what my biggest fear is? That nobody will fucking come.
Oh, well, you know what? I think that's a normal fear, but not founded, A, because it's your first. Like, it's your first, so there will be extra enthusiasm, and you just need to pick a venue, a location that works for you, whether it is working with a club who will bring their people in, or if it's a place where you know you have the most fans and friends.
Yeah.
But I think for you, as your acting career continues to grow, it makes sense to keep working on comedy, because then as acting provides more and more exposure, at some point you will hopefully hit a critical mass where now you can be known as an actor from this and that, which then will immediately exponentially increase your bookability and money from stand-up.
Yeah.
So, like, keeping that sharp, you know, you may hit at some point in a couple of years where all of a sudden, not only is your acting career much closer to where you want it to be, that will automatically, like, in that case, that is a, you know, a rising tide lifts all ships.
Mm-hmm.
Versus, like, having a nice podcast is, like, not really going to lift my career.
Well,
but having the exposure of TV and movie appearances will be that significant exposure.
Yeah, I think, well, this is a thing where I think we're in concert with, where it's just like you doing, I don't really know that, I get what you say when you talk about, like, doing the road is kind of a selfish thing. But it is kind of like that, but it's like, I love this shit. Like, I love going, doing the road, or just, even though I'm not making money off of it, you know, I'm not making a lot of money off of it.
Oh, don't get me wrong. I love waking up, going to a hotel gym, and then walking around the mall, seeing a movie, eating Cheesecake Factory, and doing some shows.
It's the shit.
I love that. But I'm now at a point where I'm just like,
yeah.
If I don't have any work, I'll do that.
Mm-hmm.
Because some money is better than no money.
Right.
But I've made too many trade-offs the last, like, 4 or 5 years. The last 5 years, really, thinking I really still had a shot, whether it was Corolla or the CK video or Keep My Enemies Closer or Levitar. Like, I've always had things that have given me moderate reason to be hopeful.
Mm-hmm.
So I kept passing on, well, I can't take this job because I have 2 weeks of work in August, so I want to really crush those gigs, and then maybe I'll make a trip here since I'll be free. But now it's just like, I need to make money, so these things impede my ability to make the money that I need.
Yeah.
You know?
I need to make money. I totally get it, man. I totally... But at least you have a girlfriend.
Yes, but that's balanced by having a dog that doesn't like me.
Yeah, well, I mean,
so there's,
like,
still conflict in my home.
Can we really fucking have it all? I don't know. Shit,
didn't we almost have it all?
Yeah.
Can I give you 10 more minutes and then go take my opioids?
Oh shit! Well, we didn't even get to the front runner.
Well, let's start now. If that's cool.
Let's do it. Do you want to pause and take the opioids? Can you?
No,
or you get knocked out.
I want to sit in a chair and let the world wash over me.
Oh boy! All right. Well, but we always do this shit whenever we talk, man.
JL starring in his own remake of A Comic Is Born.
It would be, but instead of opioids, it would be the was it fucking. Insomnia cookies. They mentioned.
Oh yeah, no, I
My favorite new show, this is how I know I'm getting old. I'm watching CBS shows. My favorite show is God Friended Me right now. My favorite new show about the black.
Is it good?
It is good. And you like God. You're a Christian. You'd like it. It's like Touched by an Angel with a millennial. And with a white girl and his Arab friend. And they mentioned, like, oh, let's go to Insomnia Cookies on Ludlow. I was like, I know where that is. I know exactly where that is. That's real. But let's get to the front runner. I'll read the blurb about it. You know, so we'll do this. All right, here we go. Gary Hart, former senator of Colorado, becomes the front runner for the Democratic presidential nomination in 1987. Hart's intelligence, charisma, and idealism makes him popular with young voters, leaving him with a seemingly clear path to the White House. All that comes crashing down when allegations of an extramarital affair surface in the media, forcing the candidate to address a scandal that threatens to derail his campaign and personal life. This movie was written by Jason Reitman, Matt Bai, and Jay Carson, and directed by Jason Reitman. JL, what are your thoughts?
I was very excited to see this movie because it had a strong cast. Mm-hmm. In the preview, you got Hugh Jackman, J.K. Simmons, Vera Farmiga. Mm-hmm. It's an October political release, but it's also hedging into that Oscar season time.
Right.
Not October, November. So definitely Oscar season. So all those, even though I saw that it was only around like 60-something% on Rotten Tomatoes, I said, you know what? I still want to see it because it's, and I saw it like you did on Election Day. So yeah. I thought very well timed. Let's say Jason Reitman's done some good stuff. I was a huge fan of Up in the Air.
Same.
I thought that was an excellent movie. So I was like, all right, boom, I'm in. I like political movies. I like historical movies. This looks like it might have a little bit of humor, a little bit of a, you know, modern day. And I got what they were doing from the trailer, which is to say, this is the election, as I knew a little bit from reading, but it was just a little bit before my real awareness.
Sure.
You know, I was 9 years old. I was not yet. I mean, I remember the name Gary Hart. That's about it.
Right.
But, you know, I get what they were doing. Like, this is when politics became, you know, kind of tabloidy and dirty. And I thought the idea was going to be like, oh, do you realize we lost what could have been a great president because of this kind of shallow stuff that used to get ignored?
Mm-hmm.
That said, my biggest problem with the movie, which I found to be like fine, I was like, oh, it's not a bad movie. I think people are fairly good in terms of their performances. Hugh Jackman, I think, is just a little, as Bill Burr joked on Conan, he's like a real big guy.
Yeah.
I felt like he was a little too big maybe for Gary Hart.
Was he like Idris Elba as Mandela? He looked like a strong safety playing Mandela.
Well, you know, and my brother corrected me on that because I did find that funny with Elba, except Mandela when he was younger was a boxer. Like, he's a fairly tall guy and a boxer, so it wasn't as big as... Did you like that Mandela movie with Idris?
It was all right.
Oh, I liked it. Okay. My problem with the movie is that I never, and I subsequently read this in a review, but I had the thought as well. I'm not just stealing from other reviews.
Mm-hmm.
I would have been much more curious to see why Gary Hart was such an amazing politician.
Yeah.
And such an inspiration. Like, in other words, it's J.K. Simmons basically telling me how great Gary Hart is. And then because I think they had this gimmick. They were like, we're just going to focus on 3 weeks from the time he announces to the time he's out, just to show you how the media can turn things so quickly into this and that, and how these decisions to expose him basically ruined this at the speed of light. You know, parentheses, now imagine how bad it can be in social media. But I considered half of a movie focused on Gary Hart, the politician, showing me, because everything I read about him since is like, oh, he was warning about Middle East terror. He was warning about radical Islam, but he was also talking about technology, and he was talking about losing middle-class jobs to trade and globalization. Like, he's had a very deep, futuristic kind of perspective that he's been proven right on a lot of things. Mm-hmm. That would have been cool to see. Now, they have little clips, and he says certain things if you're paying close attention. And I think rather than going for the gimmick of, like, look what we do in 3 weeks, we're going to show you how politics changed forever. Mm-hmm. No, show me why he's so great and why we should regret that he's not president. Don't just have J.K. Simmons tell me he was going to be a great president.
It's just a couple of flourishes where they were like, oh, shit. Like,
right. You know what I mean? So it would have been like a fuller movie instead of focusing on, like, because I think sometimes that's either a writer or a director kind of wanting to, with the phrase, stunt on them. In other words, look what I'm going to show you just in 3 weeks. I think Christopher Nolan, when he's at his worst, can be one of these directors who's like, yeah, I could give you the story, but I'd rather do it with, like, you know, 8 behind the back dribbles and, you know, unnecessarily make a no look pass.
Which Nolan movie are you thinking of?
Dunkirk.
Yeah, I still need to see it. I fell asleep in that movie, not because of the movie, because I was just exhausted, but all these bombs.
But Dunkirk
going
was an example. Unlike Inception or The Dark Knight, where he does a little trickery, or Memento, obviously. Mm-hmm. Dunkirk was almost like, I don't want to just do a cool war movie. I want to do a Nolan war movie. You know what I mean? And this movie felt like they wanted to show that they could draw out all these important themes about our future from just 3 weeks. But it's like, it would have been more interesting if I had kind of gotten more of a picture of why Gary Hart was so... was such a valuable loss. Like, all I felt was like, oh, okay, this dude doesn't get to be president because he fucked some chick.
And all
but
these...
it would have been more, like, if you'd shown me that he could have been a great president, or that he knew things that we wouldn't know for 20 years, then I could go, wow, maybe that does make me think, like, if you have a guy who's super qualified and smart, maybe we should look past, or at least give me the dilemma. Do you look past it if a guy is really great, or do you put your foot down and stand for something higher? Like, what would you do? In this case, it was just like, J.K. Simmons is telling me that he should be our president, and he flirted with this model, and now he's not.
It just assumes that we already know that it's all inherent, that we, I mean, and I get it, because, like, I get the vibe of it, because it's sort of, I think you make a very valid point, and it's sort of like, you see all these young people believing in him, and the thing that struck.
But you never show me why they believe.
Right, that's what I mean. Like, it's just, you just kind of have to glean that off, and that's kind of what I thought about it going in, where I was just like, well, this guy's supposed to be the shit. I mean, and you those conference almost like. What's that movie with George Clooney where he played the candidate? Was he a presidential candidate or a governor? And Philip Seymour
Hoffman. Gosling.
Yeah, Gosling was
Gosling
in it.
Gosling in that one?
Yeah.
Was that The Ides of March?
Yeah, that one.
That didn't get great reviews, but I really liked it.
It was solid. I liked it too. But I couldn't help but think of, and correct, bring me back if I'm going out on a limb. But when I saw this movie, it made me think a little bit about Elliot Spitzer and Anthony Weiner, where, like, these two guys, now you being a lifetime New Yorker, can you speak a little bit to the potential they had to be great politicians, or were they doing things that would have made New York better, despite their sexual proclivities and everything?
I will say that, and I think Bill Clinton, I'll get to Bill Clinton in a second, because I think that's a better comparison. But with New York, Spitzer was an incredibly intelligent guy.
Yeah.
Like, really intelligent. And he, at the right moment in time, like, had he never had that scandal, I think he would have made a serious challenge for the White House. I'm not saying he would have won it. He's still a liberal Jewish guy from New York. But given his intellect and the fact that he made his reputation basically taking down corrupt people on Wall Street, I think that would have played very well with Main Street, so to speak, in terms of, you saw what it did when people could claim that Hillary Clinton, you know, was giving speeches to Goldman Sachs. Yeah. Well, how are you going to turn that on Elliot Spitzer when he's taking down financial, like, wrongdoers and like, policing Wall Street? So I think he did, I think his potential was very high. I don't know if he would have become president, but I think he would have been a legitimate presidential contender.
Mm-hmm.
And I know Jewish friends would probably say, oh, please, you look at Trump, there's no way we'd have elected a Jewish president. Probably not, but it's possible.
Yeah.
And I think he had that kind of trajectory. But if you're going to be messing with finance guys who sleep with prostitutes, you probably shouldn't be sleeping with prostitutes. Like, if they're going to look for your weakness, you probably shouldn't be going to the same brothel. And I think with Anthony Weiner, I think he probably would have beaten Bill de Blasio for mayor in 2013, because he is a brash, sharp, proud kind of New York Jewish guy who I think would play beyond, you know, he made a reputation as a congressman for being an outspoken, sharp guy. He was media savvy. Unfortunately, he was not social media savvy. So I think both of those guys had, but those are also guys who I think did things that were slightly out of the norm in terms of prostitutes and dick pics. At least they're not as out of the norm now, probably, but they're still out of the norm in the political game. Whereas, like, Bill Clinton to me is much more the example. Like, if these people made a movie about Bill Clinton, it would be J.K. Simmons telling people how smart Bill Clinton is, how when he speaks, people are enthralled and feel important. He has that kind of empathy and that kind of one-on-one connection that makes people believe. And then the rest of the movie would have been just him getting a blowjob from Monica Lewinsky.
Yeah, and you know,
like,
we had,
like, in other words, you would have been like, can you show me Bill Clinton being charismatic? Can you show me being smart and show him talking to different people and how we get that connection, rather than just being like, hey, here's 7 minutes spread out over the film of him being like discussing policy and showing that he doesn't care about all the BS of politics, that he just wants to do policy and ideas. And that came across.
And we
the
had
the fact that he was,
and we had primary colors too, you know, that was,
sure. That was pretty good. That was like an intense movie. I remember just feeling that movie was very dark.
Yeah, that was something. But I just thought about those two because of the potential that was squashed.
Sure. Oh, right. I gotcha.
And
gotcha.
Bill,
right.
Bill got through.
Realized his potential.
Yeah.
So I think Gary Hart probably had more potential than those two, given that he was, based on everything you read and hear in the movie, you know, good looking, from Colorado, so not necessarily a Mr. Elite liberal on the coast, big idea guy, but like seemed to have all that you'd want in a president. And he would have been going up against, you know, older establishment George Bush.
Right.
So he might have had a shot. Probably better than the other two guys, but the other two guys didn't reach their potential either.
It just seemed like he was so, like, the way that Jackman portrayed him was just like, I don't get why anybody wants to know about that I'm fucking these people. So let's just,
I care about the sanctity of this process, whether you do or not.
Yeah, and that's gonna be the Oscar scene. But it's just
Golden Globe nomination at best, just because he's Australian.
I'm trying to think. Well, see, it's too early. I mean, I can't think of any. I can't think of any dudes right now. I can think of,
well, Bradley Cooper.
Yes. Yeah. Bradley, and who else? I can't think of any dudes. Maybe Green Book. Maybe Vigo. But he said nigger. At the motherfucker said nigger after a Q&A. He was like, yeah, nobody says nigger anymore. He wasn't saying it to be mean, but he just said the word, and so he's not getting an Oscar now. So Mahershala Ali, I guess, is going to get nominated. I don't know, but it seems like that's his movie. It's sort of like a reverse What did Denzel get nominated? Cry Freedom, in a way, where it's like, not because of the, there's no African stuff going on, but But it's like it's like Steve Biko, Denzel's Steve Biko, was like the supporting actor, and Kevin Kline's character was like the lead. So it's like maybe like how Last King of Scotland, it was weird because Forest Whitaker.
Nicholas, you were supposed to persuade me.
Yeah. So I don't know, man. I don't know. But we know Melissa McCarthy will get a nomination, not because, you know, I helped her get it in that scene.
But because it's always weak for women, and she was good.
Nah, man, it's going to be, you know, that Destroyer, I saw that trailer from Nicole Kidman. I'm excited to see that. But and she's already won. And then to me, like I say this every year, the female race is always more interesting to me because it seems like they get to do, I don't know, that maybe I'm.
Ooh, saying, I'm going to tell you right now. And I'm not usually one of these British royalty type uh-huh. things, but there's a movie coming out with Saoirse Ronan and
Mary Queen of Scots.
And having just, because I don't know a lot about that era, but I'm reading this big history book that touched on it.
Of course,
so it was well timed. No. It's like it was just a few pages about European. It's a book on American history.
I'm just giving you shit. Poking fun.
But I know. But what was so weird is like a day or two earlier, I just finished like the little segment that was discussing British history in like the 1600s or whatever.
Yeah.
So it was weird that I saw that preview. I was like, oh. That could be one, since that stars, you know, two nominees from last year going head to head.
That would be good
in a historical pick. Mm-hmm. But I think the movie I'm looking forward to, but then I kept thinking about it. Maybe this was just some woke file thinking going on in my head.
Okay.
But The Mule with Clint Eastwood.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah.
Where I'm like, this looks great. But then I kept thinking to myself, I'm like, I don't know how I feel about this angry conservative Trump loving dude, you know, getting us to sympathize with the senior citizen white guy drug dealer.
Yeah.
I tried to do the best I could. Whereas if it was like a 50-year-old black dude, they'd be like, this kingpin has been ruining our culture for decades. You know what I mean? Like, but in this one, you're like, God, life is tough. He acknowledges his mistakes. Mm-hmm. I'm rooting for him.
Well, you know, it's, I mean, you got to give up suspension of disbelief, but we're fucking comics and you're going to definitely zero in on that. But yeah, like that looks like that. I'm going to see it. You know,
oh, hell yeah.
You know, that, I mean, Clint Eastwood, he's put out some.
But like I said, it's not just because it's a white dude. It's also speaking at the Republican convention
with
white
that chair,
dude.
Talking to that chair and shit.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. It's like, if Bryan Cranston did this, I'd be like, well, I'm in.
Yeah.
But like, you know. We'll
what do you think of them doing that movie? They're going to do a movie. A Breaking Bad movie.
I'm not for it.
I don't think so either, dude. Like,
I know some people are like enjoying it just because we're all about nostalgia and making ourselves feel better with the things we already like.
Absolutely not. From five years ago, though. It's not even, how long has it been?
No, we're speeding up the process.
Shit, you already got Better Call Saul.
That's what I'm saying. I'm like, I don't need, and nor do I want. The show was a masterpiece.
Yeah.
Leave it be. And you managed to strike gold by, like, getting a critically acclaimed spinoff.
Mm-hmm.
So leave it, Brian, you know, you're going to end up getting 12 years out of this world. Leave it be.
Yeah.
You're good enough, Vince Gilligan. You can do other things.
You can make something else. So you did, I liked it. I liked, you know, and getting back to what we were talking about earlier about Burr, I liked the fact that he chose to do this. I'm sure maybe he read for it or somebody, you know, he got the movie. I liked his choice, you know, like that was a nice role for him, you know, I thought to play.
Yeah.
And that's like, that gives me hope. I mean, you know, obviously we're three comics in it, Bill Burr, Mike Lawrence and Kevin Pollak.
Yes, indeed.
Yeah, so that was
a lot of lines from Mike Lawrence.
I couldn't hear him though.
Well, no, I think his character they casted so well because I think the character said "bearded guy who mumbles," and they were like, "I think we've got the perfect guy."
Yeah, yeah. It was good seeing seeing him up there like that. That was pretty cool. It's like comics are getting in these things, man. But I liked seeing Bert. That was a thing that kind of excited me to see him in there.
Sure.
And you know, I thought Vera Farmiga's, she's always good, and you know, I
missed her in Bates Motel. Did you ever watch Bates Motel?
I watched maybe a couple episodes of that.
I liked that show. What I would say about the movie, if the people who are listening for a specific review, is I would say that if Rotten Tomatoes has it at 60%, that's what I would give it. Like, I'd say barely fresh. Like, I give a thumbs up just because I'm not giving it a thumbs down.
Mm-hmm.
But I didn't, I thought it was like, as far as political dramas go or historical dramas, it was like serviceable, but not something I'm going to see again. And it's more a story that I'd rather see retold the way we sort of described.
Yeah.
With more information on the candidate, more reason to care, other than some people in the movie telling me why I should care.
It's a lot better than The Post, though. Like, as far as like, it less boring than The Post.
See, I disagree. Like, I put it kind of at the same level as The Post, except I like Tom Hanks and Meryl Streep more than I like,
of course,
Hugh Jackman.
Yeah, maybe that's not. Maybe I spoke too. Yeah, you're right.
No, it's okay, because I wasn't. The Post disappointed me too. I felt like it was, you know, Spielberg, Streep, and Hanks is like Chris Bosh, Dwayne Wade, and LeBron James.
Right.
But they came in there like the Heat did against the Mavericks.
Right.
It was like, come on, man, we're the big three. We got this. And yeah. I was like, do you?
It's like, it would be a good movie to be in. Like, oh, I'm in this cool movie with all these people. Like, but yeah.
Oh, hell yeah.
It's just like, it was all right. Like, yeah. Yeah. It's just like, you don't have to rush to see this one. Matinee, I would say.
Yeah.
Well, plug some stuff, JL. This has been great as always to chat with you.
Well, thank you. Absolutely. And I'm gonna get high like a West Virginia white trash Trump supporter after I hang up.
And then they'll make a Netflix documentary out of you.
That's right. What do I have to plug? Well, there's Making Podcasts Great Again, my Trump podcast, new every Wednesday on iTunes and Stitcher. Would love for people to subscribe to that. It's, like I said, it's usually, you know, around 40 minutes a week, pure comedy. So it's a good diversion. If you're a political person, it gives you a nice like rest from the seriousness of it while still ridiculing our terrible president. And the only other thing to plug right now would be, you know, Thoughts and Prayers, my new album. It's on iTunes, Google Play, Amazon, and the cheapest option is CD Baby. So if you look up, you know, my name on CD Baby, it's $12.99 there. So digital or hard copy. So if anybody likes me, if anybody has thought about this, if we have fans in common or not in common, but who remember that they like me, you know, go purchase that, I guess, hopefully. You should like it.
Well, there you go. Stay on the line, JL. Thanks so much, JL, for doing the pod, and we'll talk to you next time, everybody. Take it easy. Time, everybody.